right, ladies and gentlemen around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Soloff and Cervantes show here on WWDB Talk 860. We've got a fantastic show. We are going, our guest is a fantastic attorney, Jeffrey Fritz, here from Soloff and Cervantes. Jeff, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How you doing, Joe? Good to see you again.
It's a pleasure to be here, and we're here with our host, John Cervantes. John, how are you?
I think I'm well.
You're damn right you are. You look great, for crying out loud. So today we're doing a show. I call it a case watch. It's about a high-profile case that has been, you know, the talk of the town. Okay, it's been in the news, and you know, we're really appreciative to have Jeff Fritz, of Soloff and Cervantes, on the broadcast, because he was the attorney representing the plaintiff in the case. And so, you know, it is just an amazing case. I don't know how you do it. First of all, if you would, Jeff, a little bit about yourself and your area of practice. Civil sexual assault is one of those areas. It's an incredibly sensitive area. And you've been doing it successfully for a long time, and it takes a special individual to do so. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Sure. So actually this year, 2024, I'm with Soloff and Cervantes 25 years.
And yet you're only 35. How did that happen, John?
I don't know.
Are you recruiting attorneys at 10 years old? What's going on around
here? He's a prodigy.
So I've been practicing about 28 years, and after a year or two, I handled my first case representing victims of crime, and it was totally foreign concept to me. Unlike representing, I had represented railroad workers and people who were injured through negligence of others, car accidents, slip and falls, medical malpractice, things like that. I did my first crime victims case, and I said, you know what, this feels totally different.
Right.
And I feel good about it, and frankly, you just get treated better in the court system sometimes, and because you're
representing somebody who's a victim.
Who's a victim, who's completely innocent.
But it's interesting on that pact. It is a really interesting area that, you know, that you mentioned, because I look at a lot of medical malpractice and somebody driving a car who gets T-boned as victims also, but I know exactly what you're saying. You know, people tend not to sympathize with people like that, and it's, I think, unfortunate, but you're in a situation where you're representing individuals who are victims, but also it kind of wraps itself around criminal law as well, so there's a criminal element typically to your cases.
Sure, so every case sort of starts with a criminal, at least looking at things criminally. But in a lot of cases, there's no criminal charges that can be filed, either because the time has passed and they can't be filed, or the prosecutor makes a decision, DA, prosecutor, hey, there's not enough here for us to go on, and so we can't bring criminal charges. So, you know, we call it like parallel justice. There's two tracks. There's two paths you can go down, criminal or civil, or both. And in a perfect world, we'd be able to successfully navigate both paths, but you don't always have that option. So sometimes a civil case is the only thing that's available to get any form of justice. And if I may add, John has been successfully representing victims of medical malpractice, and I always point this out. John's always trying and going after negligent doctors or medical providers or hospitals who are generally in this to help people.
Sure.
By contrast, the people that I'm going after are the criminals, and they're generally out there to hurt people.
Right.
So it does facilitate sort of, you know, successes that way, and I don't have the nerve to do what John does.
Well, it's interesting. I will tell you this, and John and I, obviously, we've done a lot of shows, and medical malpractice has been some of the topics, but in both cases, you're representing, you're talking about seeking justice, number one. But number two, I always say this, change happens in the courtroom on both situations. So, you know, negligence in both cases, the goal is not to only represent your client well, but also to make sure it doesn't happen with anybody for anybody else.
Absolutely.
And I think that idea really plays well in Jeff's cases.
Yeah.
Because there's a motivation behind your verdict in that case, because if the criminal justice system doesn't serve the victim,
sure,
the civil justice system will. So there's like a second shot at trying to...
Well, O.J. Simpson, that case would be a good example.
Yeah.
It's the prime example.
Yeah.
Right. And so he obviously...
You know, we get into... I'm sorry, I cut you please. Off. But you get into I think it's very important to point this out. In a criminal setting, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. And you have the situation in New York right now with Trump's trial where, you know, he's got all these felony charges. And notwithstanding who the defendant is... beyond a reasonable doubt is a huge hurdle, huge. And all you have to do is have one juror say, I don't believe that he did this. They haven't met their burden. And the defendant will walk. And I'm not making any opinion as to guilt or innocence in that case. What I'm pointing out is that you have this tremendous burden of beyond a reasonable doubt, whereas in a civil case, it's more likely than not.
51-50?
It's just enormously different.
Sure.
And I watched Jeff try that case, I watched him do his closing, and he correctly pointed out to the jury, reminded them, you know, this is more likely than not standard. We're not here to argue reasonable doubt. Because you think about that for a second. It's not too hard if you're a defense lawyer to get up and just argue, point out every discrepancy in the whole prosecution,
right,
and say, example one, reasonable doubt, example two, reasonable doubt.
Would you say, in a sense, it's almost like common sense? In other words, you know, if you use common sense, then, you know, a reasonable doubt is, you know, not hard to come by.
Right.
Correct. And, I mean, just this common sense, too, though, on the civil standard, in that, is it more likely than not that we've proven our case?
Well, that's what I meant. Is it more likely? Does common sense prevail here? Is it more likely that this occurred, you know, or didn't occur, whatever the situation is? So, we're talking about that area. I always wondered, okay, when it came to, I didn't really always wonder. I remember the first time I had one of them was here when we did one of our first shows together. You always, you know, as a layperson, you sit down and you go, well, somebody commits a crime, okay, and they're going to jail. I'm talking about just, you know, if it was a criminal case, not a civil case, and that person is going to jail. Who are you going to sue, right? And then, of course, I was educated. So that's where, you know, justice can happen for somebody because there can be way more than one, you know, negligent individual, including the perpetrator.
Exactly. And that's really what we're looking for. And if we get a call from somebody who was a victim of a crime, somebody told me a long time ago, and it took 2 seconds for it to sink in, there's nobody that I can't help. Maybe the manner in which I help somebody is different for each person, but there's always some help. So, for example, somebody is assaulted, but there's no criminal perpetrator who's caught, or maybe it happened in a spot that's there's no liability on them, or there's no insurance or anything like that, and there's no civil case that can be pursued, there's still recovery available. There's recovery in the form of what's called crime victim compensation. Every state has a program for that. So anybody that calls us, we can help them in one way or another. And it's just a question of what works best for them and what their decision is. Because just because a case can be pursued civilly doesn't mean that it should. I think that's an individual choice of the victim, because they may say, you know what, this is too much. I'm tapping out. I can't do it.
Well, and this case, okay, well, you know, so there are so many, you know, your firm, Jeff, you have represented a number of situations that, you know, involving organizations. And I'm just going to name not anything specific, but you have the Glenn Mills situation, you have the Catholic Church, you have, you know, all kinds of situations across the board.
Penn State, Sandusky,
yeah,
Larry Nassar,
right?
Jeffrey Epstein.
And then there are so many different elements to it, okay? Number one, you know, I always, especially in the Catholic Church, I always wondered statutes of limitations. These are one of the things that this firm has done so incredibly well is, you know, you don't just get good at this area of the law. Your entire firm, from the individual answering the call, okay, this can be incredibly difficult for somebody to even admit, okay, and, you know, and to you know, actually make that call. So yourself, the firm, talk about the culture here that makes it, you know, comfortable for somebody who may have gone through some, it may be a man, okay? It may have happened when he was a youngster, maybe a woman, it could be any type of situation, but talk about how, what people can, you know, expect in that situation when they make the call to hear.
So, one of the things that was surprising to me, which I hadn't thought about before, is oftentimes the first person that a victim talks to about their victimization is an attorney. I wouldn't naturally think that way.
Sure.
But it's true. They don't know what to do. They want to sort of find out the basics of what are my rights? What can I do at this point?
What am I going to go through?
Yeah. And frankly, it might be easier for them to talk to a complete stranger in confidence than to go to a family member or a, you know, friend or something. It's easier to talk to somebody that way. So for that reason, we try to be as trauma-informed as we can and just recognizing that this isn't a car accident. This isn't, you know, your run-of-the-mill case, and you have to look at things differently. And really, and this really comes, is the case with all cases, is the client's in control. You know, you have to go at the comfort level of that client. What are they comfortable talking about? What are they comfortable doing? Or maybe they're not comfortable with anything and not doing it. At least they're making an informed decision.
So, John, on that note, okay, I'm sure, you know, this is such a sensitive area, okay? As a firm, you know, you guys are a great team. But those discussions, especially when you first started getting into it, when you're making sure, listen, I got some great friends, I do, but I wouldn't have them answering the phone, situations where their sensitivity. Talk about once this becomes an area of the law of what you're representing. How do you take an overview of like we're talking about with Jeff, where you make sure that, you know, your key attorneys that are handling these situations and the individuals, the team answering the phones, there's the right approach when it comes to a situation that may, like Jeff said, the first person they may talk to is an attorney. So how do you handle that?
With us, we have a system in place where you can go on our website and you can create an email inquiry and send it in.
Okay.
And then we'll have...
Including anonymously, too.
Anonymously, yeah, actually. I mean, there's got to be a way to get back to that individual.
Sure.
Through an email or a telephone number. But we encourage people to be as thorough as they can be without violating any confidences or embarrassing themselves. Because we do screen cases from an initial email sometimes. I mean, you got to have something.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, we'd be calling a lot of people back with just a blank canvas, not really knowing or understanding why they reached out to us. So it's important for your listeners, if they're interested in contacting us, to put enough in an email so that we know what we're calling you back on and give us an idea of whether we believe we can help them. Also, you know, you can always call and a service will send us whatever message that they send, and then we'll make sure that the right attorney calls that individual back.
Tailored to the type of case.
Yeah, tailored to the type of case. I mean, obviously...
That's a great point.
Yeah, you know, we have different lawyers doing different things here. Obviously, if it's a sexual assault or a harassment case or a crime victim's case, the person that we like to farm those cases off to would be Jeff. But if Jeff's not available, somebody else has to step in and look at it. Or oftentimes, somebody else will screen it and then bounce it off of Jeff. I mean, ultimately, Jeff will make the call as to whether or not we want to represent or we believe we can help that individual.
So talk about that conversation, even the first time, Jeff. I mean, you're obviously a successful professional, but also having that sensitivity. What is that conversation like, and what approach do you take? You know, you're sitting across from a very sensitive situation.
So I think it's mostly about, in talking to somebody for the first time, it's what are they comfortable telling me? And just having, I guess, checks along the way of the conversation. So, for example, especially I get calls from parents on behalf of children who were either sexually assaulted, physically assaulted, or something like that. And it might be months before I ever talk to that child. There's no reason for me to talk to that child. If there is an investigation or whatever, I want to find out that those facts first, or from the parents or from the prosecutor or something like that. There's no reason for me to just start interviewing a child. So that's one example. But it's really, it's a case-by-case basis, and it's what's their comfort level and proceeding at their comfort level. But at the same time, letting them know that our conversation is confidential, that there are certain protections in place. For example, they don't have to disclose their name. They can proceed under what's called a pseudonym, Jane Doe, John Doe. Or they can, there's certain aspects of a case that can be under what's called a protective order or a confidentiality order, because, you know, people don't want all their horrible trauma that happened to them plastered all over the place.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of, you know, other protections that can be taken to help them. And just really explaining these tools that most people don't know about. Half the lawyers don't even know about this stuff.
Well, you think about how long, you know, that it may have taken for somebody to actually even talk about something like this.
Can we take the case
that
we're here for as an example?
Exactly.
It is an example.
I was doing some research on, you know, on the, you know, and if you would, you know, let's first of all, from day one, did you get the call from the victim or a referral from somebody who knew you would be the perfect, you know, firm and attorney?
Sure. So without revealing any confidences, I was contacted directly by the victim. And it was one of those situations where I was at least one of the first person that the victim had disclosed this to. And by the way, the case that we're talking about is Jane Doe, which is a pseudonym, versus the Camden City School District Board of Education and Don Walker, also known as Wasim Muhammad. The case is pending and brought in Camden County, New Jersey, in state court, and recently went to trial about a month ago.
And so it's a very interesting case. I know that there could be some appeal type situations, and some of the, you know, there were a couple parts to the actual the case, but the headline, I believe, in Philly.com was jury awards plaintiff $1.6 million in sex abuse trial against Wasim Muhammad. Okay. I don't know exactly what we can talk about, but let's start back about, sure, you know, what the accusations were and you know, what the crime was. And I know we're talking about the civil side. So let me ask you a question. Was this brought to light well after the statute of limitations was, available in a criminal sense?
Yeah. So that's a heck of a blue book question there, Joe, but yeah. We'll break it down.
Sure.
So there's a couple statutes of limitations, which are time limits that come into play here. There's criminal statute of limitations and there's civil statute of limitations.
Sure.
Let me break that down. So statute of limitations, just what's the time limit for bringing your case? And criminally, at the time that this happened, let me explain. What happened was my client, Jane Doe, she was in the seventh grade at Cooper B. Hatch Middle School in the Camden City School District, Camden, New Jersey. And she had a teacher. His name at the time was Don Walker. He now goes by a different name, Wasim Muhammad. He started what we call grooming her, which is less aggressive acts, let's call it, but, you know, acts of paying special attention to her.
Getting her confidence.
Correct. Gaining trust.
Yes.
And as these cases go, and what happens, unfortunately, is it starts with grooming, and progresses on to the worst behavior in humanity.
Sure.
In fact, it's inhumane. And that's what happened here. So he started grooming her in seventh grade. He continued to assault her in the eighth grade and ninth grade. She moved out of New Jersey down south in the ninth grade, and he actually took trips down south to where she lived, visited her there, assaulted her there as well. The problem was, and this is typical, she didn't tell anybody about this. And that's so typical for any kind of sexual assault survivor, whether it's a child, especially when it's a child, but as adults as well, too. I don't know whether you guys know this, but the average age for a victim of child sexual abuse to come forward, venture a guess as to what that might be.
I mean, I'm
average age?
Average age.
40s?
I'm going to say 32.
52 years old.
Wow.
Multiple studies on that.
Wow.
Well, this particular victim reached out to me in her early 40s, to your point, John, but the average age is 52. So what's happened is, on the civil side of things, states have recognized the need for the law to kind of catch up with the social science on this. If you have the average age at being age 52, but the statute of limitations being either 2 years or 5 years or 10 years from the date, right, then that doesn't match up too well.
Exactly.
So what states have done, some states better than others, some not so well, is they've opened up what are called window statutes. And the window is, I always think back to the Kmart Blue Light Special. Do you remember that?
Yes.
It's available only for the next 30 minutes.
Next 30 minutes, if you do this, you're going to get this deal in Kmart. My parents took me to Kmart every Sunday afternoon. So that's the idea, is if you act within that window time, within that, some states it's 1 year, some states it's 2 years. In New Jersey, it was 2 years. Or if you act by a certain age, currently that age is 55 in New Jersey, then we don't care when this abuse took place. It could have taken place 100 years ago. As long as you act within this time, then we're going to treat it as timely and you can pursue
it. And that's the civil side?
That's only the civil side.
Okay. Can you tell our listeners about Pennsylvania?
So, yeah. So here's where we are with that. Pennsylvania, the last change in the law, took the age from being age 20. So, in other words, a victim would need to come forward and file their case by age 20, and they extended it to age 30. So it's better, but not good enough, right? So,
especially if the average victim's not reporting it until they're 52.
Yeah, 22 years later, then what does age 30 do to help them, right?
Well, who, by the way, legislatively, we talk, John, you and I have done a lot of political radio, okay? And legislatively speaking, who is fighting? These are insurance company, lobbyists who are fighting to take individuals who have done the worst things imaginable, and to cut off their the ability for the victim to file a lawsuit.
So I don't want to be anti-Catholic in this response, yeah, but it's the truth.
God, please.
The number one entity fighting against these changes in the law is the Catholic Church. And the insurance lobby, obviously. It's not exclusively that, and I'm not anti-Catholic at all.
I am Catholic, and I...
So am I.
My point is, I have enough problems with that whole situation, and I speak freely of it. So I'm not surprised, and I am ticked off about it. But
so we were real close in Pennsylvania with getting a new window legislation passed a few years ago. There was a mess up by the then Secretary of State, Bachvar, I believe her name was. And in fact, it led to her resigning ultimately. So it put us back a few years. I firmly believe we're going to get that change to happen. It's a question of when and how and what it's going to look like. But so by comparison, New York passed these changes in the law in locally. New York, Delaware, New Jersey, Maryland, all the surrounding states to Pennsylvania have opened up windows. Pennsylvania has not yet.
Except to 30.
Except to age 30. And
you would think that Governor Shapiro, who has prosecuted the Catholic Church.
He's tried. He was the one behind the effort the last time.
Yes.
Well, let's get back on that bandwagon. But, yeah, now it's justice you know, is, you know, for anybody that's going through something like this, first of all, I know that, you know, this is homicide. There is no statute. I think this should be right up there from a criminal standpoint, but this is civil. So I get what you're saying.
Yeah. So for example, in this case, the Doe versus Camden City School District, the current statute of limitations criminally, there is none, right? So if it happened today, it could be prosecuted 50 years from now. Under the theory that you just said, under homicide and murder, there is no statute of limitations. I've heard people say sexual assault is like murder of the soul, so why should there be a statute of limitations on it, which makes sense.
And lives have been destroyed of epic proportions. There's not enough justice. And that's why I think that what you guys do. First, let me jump on this for a second also. Okay, so I'm going to take a shot. This is sarcasm, but, you know, must cost a boatload to retain attorneys like yourselves because, your education and the fight that you're going to put in is extensive, or no?
So there's two sides to that coin. Number one, we work on a contingency fee basis.
Boom.
And the idea is this, and John has the best line about this ever, but it's the great, what do you call it?
The great equalizer
that levels the playing field, right?
Levels the playing field.
Who do you think gave it to John?
Opens the courthouse doors to everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I talk about it on every show.
That's why the commerce folks and the insurance industry and everybody who has some element of power in this area want to legislate or control the contingency fees.
Oh, I get it. So only and the rich,
some states,
only the rich would be able to afford it.
But this is important for the listeners to understand. We just kind of beat Pennsylvania up for failing to open up the door and extending the statute of limitations for victims of sexual assault. However, in Pennsylvania, there's no limitation to, I mean, no lawyer is really allowed to charge 100%, but you can charge a third or whatever it is, no matter how high the verdict is, all right? In states like New Jersey and in New York, there's limitations, and there's kind of like the more money you're able to obtain for the victim or the injured individual, the less the percentage of your fee can be. And what's really particularly concerning for a guy like me who does medical malpractice work is you take a state like New York where you pretty much tell everybody, listen, you can charge 30%. But if it's a malpractice case, you're in a whole different realm, and that's controlled by how much you're able to obtain. And at some point, you have to get court approval. It actually discourages lawyers from taking on the most difficult case.
Because you have to invest in that case.
You're investing,
right?
a lot of money.
Experts.
In risk, in medical malpractice. And it kind of goes back to what we talked about when we started this discussion, is in a crime victim's sexual assault scenario, the defendant is usually an unlikable individual.
Right.
All right? In a malpractice case, you're dealing with doctors, right, and hospitals and individuals who are trying to help people. So you're taking on the most difficult case out there and legislating, controlling what attorneys can charge on the most risky case out there. So what's that going to do? It's going to discourage attorneys from taking on medical malpractice cases. And I think it's designed to limit those cases. I can tell you that it probably affects the analysis in a lot of cases.
It makes sense. One of the things that I love about the Trial Lawyers Association is that right now you guys are fighting on, you know, to for the rights of individuals that unfortunately are not, I mean, fortunately, but, you know, that who will get hurt but aren't hurt.
The example is a rear-end collision. And I always joke, and I should not say this because I'm a lawyer, but let's face it. You're not hiring a lawyer to establish who's at fault in a rear-end collision.
Right.
It doesn't take a lot of legal expertise,
right,
to create who's at fault, okay? Yeah. The burden of proof isn't a big, giant step here.
Right.
It's really all about damages and creating how bad this has affected somebody. But a lawyer can charge what they're charging. But in a malpractice case, the most difficult case out there, you're controlled on what you can charge.
Right. And I see, you know, I see where you're going. You're dealing with individuals that are, you know, typically hailed as a member of your family. But we all know that negligent situations have ruined the lives of children and all that. And what you're doing is you're making sure that justice prevails, but also that, you know, hopefully it doesn't happen to somebody else. And in a hospital, there's a chain of individuals. I remember being in the hospital for my knee. 8 people came and asked me the same question. I'll never forget because I had an infection. It was... And
that story appears 8 times in your records.
Right. Well, and here's the funny thing. But I'm like, these people aren't talking to one another. Like, I'm going, oh, my God, there's so many different. So anyway, here we are in this situation. OK. And so if somebody goes to make that call, there's no out of pocket cost. Right.
There's no out of pocket cost for the lawyer's fee that comes at the end of the case. And it comes out of the settlement or verdict or otherwise. But nobody's writing a check to hire the lawyer. On top of that, and this is, I thought, where you were getting at, is there's a lot of money invested to pursue these cases. You have to hire experts, take depositions, and a lot of expenditures. We don't go to the clients and say, hey, give us a check for $10,000, $20,000 for this. We put up that money. We'll front that money, and we get paid back if we're successful. So think about that. What if doctors work that way? You only get paid if you're successful.
Right.
And you only pay the cost of the hospital and the anesthesiologist if you're successful.
Right.
We're the only industry that does that, and it works. And it, to use John's line, it levels the playing field.
Because the reality is the average member of the public cannot afford to pay large hourly rates. So how else are you going to be able to afford a competent attorney in that setting?
Exactly.
And it's when you stop and think about it, it's probably the fairest thing you could create in order to enable people the opportunity to try to seek justice in a case where they normally wouldn't be able to afford it.
Right. Well, and by the way, you know, when I talk about all negligent injuries, typically the person is, if you're going as far as being that, you know, there's damages, you're physically injured, you can't work, something's wrong. And so it is a godsend, the contingency fee agreement. So here we are. The individual comes in, you meet Jane Doe for the first time. Okay. What is different about this case than the media, you know, it's not always accurate, but this seemed like a very different type of case.
So it's a different case for a couple different reasons. So number one, it did happen about 30 years ago. She was in seventh grade in 1992, and here she is bringing this case in 2022, right? 30 years later. So that does sometimes put up some roadblocks and makes us have to dig a little bit deeper, or a lot deeper, to find the evidence. Who's responsible for this crime? You know, not just the perpetrator, but in this case, the school district. The school district was supposed to be supervising him. They were supposed to have rules in place, training in place, and the jury found that they didn't have these things and therefore found the school district liable. But most, I think this is what you're getting at, that most importantly, this teacher, formerly Don Walker, now known as Wasim Muhammad, happens to be the current, and I mean current, as of today, still, post this verdict, the school advisory board president of the Camden City School District.
Oh, my God. So he stayed in the system.
So he was a teacher at the time for about 6 or 7, 8 years as a long-term substitute teacher, which raises red flags of its own, in my opinion. Then he leaves the school district, and he comes back and runs an election in New Jersey to be on the school board, and then the school board president.
So let's talk about the allegations.
Sure. So this teacher, as I said, he started this grooming process. He escalated it. So the grooming was touching, giving compliments, eventually kissing her, and touching her inappropriately. But again, it's, and this is a common theme in all of these cases, it's the power differential. He's a teacher, he's a person in authority, and she's a seventh grade girl.
Wow.
And so she essentially falls under his spell. She's never had a relationship with any boy, much less a man, right, before this. And she's going to follow whatever he says. And he says, you can't tell anybody. If anybody even approaches you or asks you about this, say, no, nothing's happening. If they even show you a picture of you and me together, deny it. Say, it's not me in that picture. And sure enough, that's what ultimately happened here. So he was continuing to assault her. Again, the nature of the assaults escalated to the worst possible type of sexual assaults you can even imagine.
What do you do with, how do you find evidence? How do you investigate something that happened 30-some years ago? What are the key parts of that?
So it's really just about talking to the witnesses who are available, looking at any documents that are still available. Some documents were, some documents weren't. And what we did in our investigation, we found that there was a teacher, a coworker of this Mr. Walker, who observed Jane Doe and Mr. Walker coming out of his house in Camden during the school day. And that teacher, little red flags went off in her head, alarms went off, said, this is inappropriate, this is concerning to me, what do I need to do about this? And so what did she do? She ends up talking to the victim's girlfriends, other seventh grade girls, or at that point they were in ninth grade girls, and said, hey, what's going on between these two, Mr. Walker and Jane Doe? And the response was, well, they like each other. They're boyfriend, girlfriend.
Oh.
And she then said, well, he better watch himself. He's a grown man. He needs to stay away from her. So that was her fix. And to her benefit, yes, that's wrong, but she didn't know what to do with that information. Why? Because the school district didn't tell her what to do with that information. In New Jersey at the time and presently, if you're a person who's an adult who has knowledge of child abuse in any manner, could it be physical abuse, verbal abuse, sexual abuse, you must report that to the state.
That applies to any person?
Any person in New Jersey. In Pennsylvania and other states, it applies only to, like, people who come into contact with kids, whether it's, you know, nurses or teachers, administrators, social workers, things like that. But in New Jersey, which I think is a better rule, everybody is what's called a mandatory reporter, and that's what that is.
And who are they reporting it to?
So in New Jersey, they were reporting it to what was known as DIFAS at the time, the Division of Youth and Family Services, now known as DCF, the Division of Children and Families. And that's who they need to report to. In Pennsylvania, they need to report to what's called Childline. So it's an 800 number that if you see abuse, anybody can report it. Who must report it are those who come into contact with kids in their profession.
So you have that situation. Did the teacher tell who saw them come out of the house? She went to the friends, which is a good idea. That's a great idea. Nobody told the parents?
So she actually contacted the mother as well, too.
Okay, that's a big one.
So she said, hey, Mom, I saw them together. You know, you might want to look into this. Now, again, I give her credit for doing something. She just didn't talk to the right people.
Right.
By talking to the mother goes to the child.
Right, everything's fine, right?
And the child denies it. Why? Because that's what Mr. Walker told her to do. And she was compliant and she followed his instructions. By the way, typically, that's what happens. This is exactly why you can't have school districts investigating themselves. And that's exactly why this mandatory reporting laws are in place, so that the people who are trained to deal with this know the right questions to ask, know how to ask these questions, come in and take control of the situation.
At what point did the school district find out about this? Did they know during the time?
So there was evidence that a principal from the middle school came up to my client, Jane Doe, and said, hey, why are you spending so much time with Mr. Walker? And, of course, she was compliant, denied it, and said, oh, I'm just helping him out, cleaning the classroom or whatever. And it was just left at that. The point is this. If you've got people, whether it's the principal, a teacher, anybody in the school district who's asking these questions, that's exactly the point when you know that there's a suspicion and a report needs to be made to the state so the right people can come in and ask questions.
Okay, so we're talking about the allegation. She was, how far did this go?
So, I mean, it went out for years, frankly, in that he, like I said, traveled to the South, had her come up and visit him.
What was he doing to her?
I actually don't want to get into the details, but just the worst possible forms of sexual abuse, oral, anal, vaginal rape.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And let me just ask you, so...
But he denied it.
He denied it. He denied it to a point. He said that he met up with her magically when she turned 18 and developed a relationship with her. He also claimed to have been married to her.
Well, let's talk. So this guy was a, I don't know if you call him a polygamist or what. I was reading in the newspaper, okay, that he had similar situations. And is it true that he said he met all, did he have four wives and he met them all when they were 18?
So he currently, the most he's had is six wives.
Oh.
He currently has, I think, five, and four of the five, or four of the six, he had met at either age 18 or age 18 still in high school at the time when he met them. He is a member of the Nation of Islam, and I don't mean to malign, just like I didn't mean to malign Catholic Church in any way, I don't mean to malign them at all, but they do believe and practice polygamy. And while there were some issues of that that came up during the trial, it was never my intention, nor did I ever attack the religion at all.
All right. Well, we all have friends in every faith. They don't do that.
Right.
You know, so he has this pattern. It's clearly a pattern. Okay.
In fact, I asked him that question. During the trial, I said, do you see a pattern here? Because he had admitted to meeting four of his wives when they were 18
years old. All right, now let me jump in here, John Savanos. You know, here I am, Joe Doc, an iron worker, regular guy, probably somebody you would probably want on your jury, I think, okay? And we talked about, you know...
You can be on all my juries.
I'm in. Yeah. I'm in. Can we work? But my question is, so first of all, I did learn this in the O.J. Simpson trial, that when it's a civil situation, you have to testify. Is that true or no?
So you cannot testify if you don't want to, but the jury can hold it against you if you don't testify. Unlike a criminal case where if you don't testify, it can't be held against you. It's the age-old, anything you say can and will be used against
you. So that standard we talked in, is it more likely to have happened or not? To me, it's jumping out. You know, completely through to, you know, like literally speaking, you know, the patterns that a regular person is seeing. Well, I was not at the trial and I don't have all the evidence, but my point is, it sure sounds like a common sense situation to me. And I don't know much about the evidence, but I would say that how old was the man when the assaults were going on?
So he was in his mid to late 20s when she was in the 7th, 8th, and 9th grades.
Okay. So he's coming out of her house. He's traveling to see her and all those things. Okay. And I'm not the smartest guy in the world. Okay. Not a real rocket science. Went to community college. But don't take a rocket science or me to say, well, I could be wrong about this. But do you really go that, you know, for friendship to a kid go cross state lines? How old was he when she did that?
She was 15 and 16.
Okay. All right. So, 16-year-old, you know, holy cow. Anyway, having said that, so let's talk about the trial and you know, ultimately how that went and what came to fruition.
Sure. So, we presented our case. We try to be mindful of the jurors' times and present it as succinctly as possible. It took a little over a week of trial time. The jury, there's a six-member jury that listened to this. So the two defendants, again, were the school district and Mr. Muhammad, which he goes by now. The jury deliberated for about a day and a half or so. which is a good time. They had to answer a lot of questions, 18 questions, and they rendered their decision. Some of the decisions that they made were in the negative on some of the counts. So what happens is when we bring a civil case, we're bringing it on multiple counts or multiple theories. Some of the theories they accepted, some of them they didn't accept, and ultimately they said that the school district is liable, Mr. Muhammad is liable for causing harm to her. Interestingly, one of the theories that they found positively on against the school district is that the school district, through its actions, created what's called a sexually hostile educational environment. That's a lot of words to just basically say it was an environment that she went to school in that was hostile towards her. And that became very significant in the case. And the jury made an award of, you know, what were the damages? They made an award of $1,600,000. And they were also asked to assess, well, how much is each of these parties responsible? How much is Mr. Walker / Muhammad responsible? How much is the school district? They said the school district was 60% responsible, whereas Mr. Muhammad was 40% responsible. So the school district actually found more responsible than he was, which sometimes makes you scratch your head, but not really, because, again, the focus of this case is what allowed this crime to happen and continue to happen, and who's responsible for that? Is that him, or is it the people who were supposed to supervise him? And that's what the jury decision was.
When you're, you know, in a trial like that, okay, first of all, was there any settlement offers before the actual situation went to trial?
There were. I can't get into the details, but yes, there were.
Okay. So what is when you're in the middle of that and you have that, you know, responsibility to you're representing a plaintiff, and what goes through your mind, okay, when it comes to seeking justice?
I think that's a question for John and me.
I would love, John.
Well, I'm in a different world because I have to, are you referring to when you get an offer to settle a case?
No, I'm.
How do you analyze?
Yeah, exactly.
How do you analyze what?
You know, an offer.
How hard is the case?
What's the risk involved?
That's the risk.
The jury?
You know, well, venue plays a role, obviously, in every case we have. I mean, if you're in a very conservative venue and you get a reasonable offer, you're going to be more compelled to accept that offer, especially if there's a slew of defense verdicts and a history of defense verdicts. You have to be advised accordingly, and you get to explain to your client how difficult achieving a plaintiff's verdict may be. And I think that's your responsibility as an attorney.
Well, if I could piggyback on what John's saying.
Yes.
I'm very formulaic in my approach to this. It's pretty simple. There's an upside and a downside. There's a risk and there's an upside to every case and the offer and where you're at that given point in time. I think the most important thing to do is explain both sides of it. No differently than if you're going in for surgery, there's an upside and a downside. You might die on the operating table, but chances are you won't, and you'll feel better after your surgery, right? So it's the same idea, and I just think it's about explaining it to the client, both sides of it, fairly, both sides of it, not just one side of it, both sides of it, and letting them make the informed decision. Because
There's no question. I agree with what Jeff just said. I mean, you have to have those conversations, and you say, well, if this happens, then you might get this type of result. Or if this happens, or if we get this evidence, we might get this result. Because the conversations you have with a client in the beginning of a case may be very different than the conversations you have with a client at the end of a case. Because at that point, you've had an opportunity to do discovery and learn so much more about the case itself and what you're able to prove and what you're not going to be able to prove.
I look at this case. I've been here 45 minutes, okay, talking about it, and obviously we haven't gotten into every part of the evidence or whatever, but it sure does, you know, if it looks like it and it smells like it, it's it. It to me, this situation, especially those situations, are so obvious. There's red flags. We can see them in, you know, like you can, you know, all over this thing. What is a grown man in that environment doing, hanging out and befriending a seventh grader? Okay. And by the way, how many teachers do you know, in my opinion, that followed, you know, somebody's, you know, career through high school and traveled
into adulthood?
Right. So nothing. You're telling me nothing was there. If you had the burden of proof was more likely than not happened, I'm not at all surprised at the verdict. What was it like when it finally went to verdict? And tell me, and our listeners a little bit about, you know, the Jane Doe's response when justice was finally served.
So again, without disclosing any confidential information, sure, I will tell you that the word that comes to mind, both with her and me together, simultaneously as we were sitting at council table, was vindication. So you have to understand, here is a now 45-year-old woman
that lived with that her whole life,
who's lived with it for the last 3+ decades, who is fighting for her 13-year-old self. And the whole time, for the last 3 decades, she thinks if she tells anybody, I am not going to be believed.
Right.
And that's another reason why victims don't come forward.
Well, you know what? You've been violated once, and now you're going to be blasphemed for it by somebody, or at least the fear of that.
Correct. So the fear of that keeps people silent. And actually, that was a key part of the closing argument.
Well, the guy's some high-profile individual. Who's so if I'm sitting there, you know, and I'm violated, it's probably why people don't go to high school reunions. They were picked on when they were kids. They're not going back to get
exactly round same tour idea.
Yeah, I mean, except 100 times worse.
So, yeah, there was an immediate feeling of vindication that now somebody completely objective heard the evidence and believed you. And to me, that's the greatest victory in this case.
I was going to say to you, what was your emotions when they came out? And
didn't even care what the number was. It was the vindication.
And I read her response, Jane Doe's response. And what was interesting about it is that's what it seemed like. It seemed like it was about justice. It wasn't same, you know. So, you know, yes, it, to me personally, if I'm on that jury, if there's $100 million, that's about 1/10 of what I'm, because of that setup. I want to know why the teachers, I mean, you know, and other people, you know, did not go to the wall for this little girl, because obviously if one teacher saw it, she's got to be telling. I mean, it's, you know, I can only imagine how many really saw it.
Yeah. Well, talk about going to the wall for somebody. There's an interesting footnote to this story, and it's this. When this case became public, it was filed in 2021.
Okay.
When it became public, was only this year, January of 2024, our governor, I live in New Jersey, our governor in New Jersey, Governor Murphy, immediately spoke out and said, this guy needs to resign, meaning Mr. Muhammad, the perpetrator.
I saw that.
And he didn't resign. He's still on the school
board. He's on leave, right?
He's on leave, but he's still the president of the school board.
Incredible.
Then Governor Murphy issued another statement the day of this verdict saying that he either needs to be tossed out or he needs to resign, and it still hasn't
Who's
happened.
Keeping him in there? He's obviously a danger.
The board and or the superintendent, that's the multi-million-dollar question.
Well, who has the ability to tell him you got to go?
The board or the superintendent, and it's a strange situation because the superintendent was appointed by the state because the school district is overseen by the state. It's the only school district which still is.
So, listen, this has been the fastest hour in radio, John.
This one has been fast.
It's been lightning fast. I mean, Jeff, go ahead. I'm sorry.
There's more to the story, though. Right. On June 17th, we're going back before the same jury to decide what punitive damages should be awarded in this case against Mr. Muhammad and the school district. So more to come, Joe.
Well, listen, I can't wait to find out. I want to Jeff Fritz, I want to thank, Sol Zervanos, I want to thank you not only for being our guest, but for representing an individual who couldn't represent themselves. And you do it every day. And a job incredibly well done. Okay. I will be, John, you'll be getting a call from me on June 17th at about 5 o'clock. Okay. I you know, and my thoughts and prayers go out to Jane Doe and the Jane Does across the land, who finally have individuals that will represent them, because they haven't been able to represent themselves. A job well done. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Sol Hoffman Zervanos Show. I want to thank John Zervanos, our host, for you know, putting this show together. And, of course, Jeff Fritz of Sol Hoffman Zervanos for not only, again, being our guest, but doing an incredible job. On behalf of John and Jeff, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, John.